Hello, welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey-Karras and I'm here with Amanda Hayes. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Anna. Hello, everyone.
And this week we've been reading Toxic, The Rotting Underbelly of the Tasmanian Salmon Industry by Richard Flanagan. Oh, dear. But first, book news. There wasn't much news this week, but I wanted to mention belatedly, that February is Black History Month, and it's particularly in America, I think, that it's promoted, and I see it a lot just on Instagram and the bookish people who I follow. But one of the things is to read books celebrating or highlighting Black history. And there was a great list in Esquire. So I just wanted to mention that for those listeners who want to read along. And like anything, we do this with Pride Month and Women in Translation Month. It's a good reminder and it's a good time to get those lists to broaden your reading experience. Yeah, broaden your reading. And some that caught my eye on this one, was the 1619 Project, edited by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who I think has won a Pulitzer Prize for journalism in this area. And the book, it caught my eye because I'd just seen it as well, I think on the New York Times bestseller list or something like that. And it's that marketing rule that when you see something two or three times, or I think it's the rule of seven, but you sort of buy it after you've seen it a number of times. It just appeared a few times in my day yesterday. And so the 1619 Project, I'm very intrigued by. There's a young adult book mentioned, which I'm really keen to read, called Felix Ever After, which it's sort of a young romance about a trans boy. And Luster, which Annie and I did on the podcast. And The Other Black Girl by Zakia Delilah Harris. And Zakia Delilah Harris is coming to Adelaide Writers Week.
Oh, fantastic.
I think via live stream. So that just reminded me. It's been on my radar.
Yeah, me too.
I must pick that up. So was there anything that caught your eye, Amanda?
Well, not particularly on that list, apart from the ones you've mentioned, but it did make me think of, and I've mentioned this a few times on this podcast, because it's one of those books that constantly circles back through my mind, and that is Why I'm No Longer Speaking to White People About Race by Rennie Edo Lodge.
Yes.
That was a bit of a game-changing book for me, the way she explained it all, and particularly the, you know, I'm colourblind, I don't see colour, which denies the fact that there's been so much injustice done over the years. You can't just whitewash over it. So that book to me it's a must read.
I agree. I thought that was excellent and really readable. And
yeah, totally.
So every page has something that broadens your view.
Yeah, makes you think very critically about your own views.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Now on to our book of the week. It is Toxic by Richard Flanagan. And Richard Flanagan is a very well-known, very highly celebrated Australian writer. He lives in Tasmania. He's also worked as a film director and a screenwriter, which I didn't know.
I didn't know that either.
No, and he was a Rhodes Scholar. He is best known for his novels, which he's won many, many awards. We won't list them all, but the one that most of our listeners would know is The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which won the Booker Prize in 2014. And the one that I also love is Wanting, which is set in Tasmania, but in the 1800s. When did Charles Dickens live?
Oh, gosh.
Set in the time of Charles Dickens, and it alternates a story that's in Tasmania with, I think, Franklin, the governor, and Charles Dickens in London. It's a great read. He also writes nonfiction, and he has done lots of journalism. Mm. So he has written on a wide range of topics, literature, art, politics, the environment. And recently he went with Ben Quilty, the artist, to Lebanon and Greece, and they wrote and have spoken a lot about the Syrian refugee crisis, and I think that touched them both really deeply. So he's active on that front, and he's also in the environment on the environment side, he wrote a very influential essay about guns, about logging in Tasmania. Mm. So that's just sort of by way of introduction. He's been named by the Washington Post one of our greatest living novelists, and the New York Review of Books says he's one of the most versatile writers and so on. So he's very highly regarded, and he also has a beautiful, just a warm tone to his books, doesn't he? He's a friendly writer.
He writes the way you'd expect to have a chat with him.
Yes.
You know, he feels... He's obviously incredibly intelligent, but he just feels accessible.
Yeah, I agree. Mm. So anything he writes, even this book where things can be quite bleak, and of course that can happen in a novel, it still feels like he's taking you with him and he's a comforting presence, which is lucky when it comes to toxic. So toxic is, as the subtitle suggests, the rotting underbelly of the Tasmanian salmon industry. And this is exploring, and it's really an expose of salmon industry. Yeah. It started because Richard Flanagan has a house on Bruny Island where he normally writes for at least a few months each year. He would write maybe 6 months a year. He would go there to write his novel. And so he's been going there for 30 years or more. And he describes how it was when he first was staying there with the wildlife and that what you'd expect when you think of Tasmania, which is incredibly pristine, cold waters, oceans full of fish. And he said there were penguins, there were dolphins, there were whales, there was
octopus.
I've forgotten all the various wildlife that he observed, obviously the bird life as well. And it was just this really pristine, beautiful, unspoiled place. And he started to notice a noise of a salmon feedlot or a salmon farm. And anyway, long story short, this worsened, and he went to the government about it, or he went to the regulatory body about it at one point, and because there were other concerned citizens, and just found that they were saying to him, well, we can't do anything because the government has allowed it all. And that, I think, had intrigued him. And as a novelist and as a writer, you get these things that you start to think, hang on a minute, what's going on there? And he decided to investigate further. And I think what must have happened is it just, you know, he just got drawn further and further into it. It was much more of a story than he'd anticipated.
Yes,
and it ended up becoming a whole book. And the book, plot spoiler, the book will put you off eating farmed salmon for life.
Yep.
And it's over, which I'm personally, you know, I knew that going in, I knew this would happen, but it is sad. But particularly Tasmania, I think what really shocked me was that, you know, you do associate Tasmania. They've been very successful branding themselves
Absolutely.
As a clean state.
Yeah.
And this is really has... I'm shocked, Amanda.
Yeah.
Now tell me how you found it, because I have to say I'm only partway through.
Yeah. Well, I echo your sentiments entirely. I've been watching this book, you know, every time I go to the bookshop thinking I should probably read that. Knowledge is power, I thought. But then I thought, I know that if I read this book, I will never eat farm salmon again. And that is absolutely what's happened. When Anna suggested we read it, I thought, okay, it's time. I mean, it's just a litany of horrors. I almost don't know where to start. I think – so I might mention some of the most stomach-turning aspects that I found. I think what's really interesting is because I did a bit of a deep dive into this and started watching documentaries and was looking at websites, and it is portrayed, it looks, you know, from the top where they photograph these big salmon feedlots, it actually doesn't look that destructive. You just see these big round nets, but the thing is they go down very, very deep. And they overcrowd the pens. I mean, that's a partly a financial decision, or as Richard Flanagan would say, it would be based on greed. But for whatever reason, the pens are overcrowded. They don't get enough water flowing through. And so what happens is that they become these rather filthy, murky spaces where there's a lot of disease because they're basically swimming around in their own feces. And because of that, they get sick. it's a bit like a pandemic, isn't it? So what they do then is they feed them antibiotics to reduce the risk of disease, but of course that leaches into the environment. You know, and it doesn't stop there. The other thing that I think people are probably aware of this now, I'd certainly heard about this but didn't quite know the full extent, is in the wild, salmon feed on small crustaceans, and that's where they get the pink colour from in their flesh. But that doesn't happen in a feedlot. So what they do is they add synthetic dye to the feedlot, and they actually have this thing called a samophan, which is like a paint swatch you'd buy at Bunnings with all the different colours you can dye salmon. So if they didn't include this dye in the feed, salmon would be this kind of flaccid grey.
Well, farmed salmon would be because of what they're feeding it, which is...
Yeah, so that's another thing. So we're ingesting this, it's bio-identical, but it's still synthetic dye. And interestingly, I thought, okay, this is all quite one-sided. I'm going to have a look and see if I can find something from the producer's point of view. And I did find an interview talking about this dye, and a lot was made of the fact that it's bioidentical, but it's still synthetic, and that they give it to the salmon in such small, tiny quantities that it should not impact human health. But nevertheless, once you know that, it's a bit hard to go back from there.
Mm.
Like, I just don't want to eat that.
Well, the way he described it was a petrochemical.
Yes, it is. It is.
So that just can't be good. But I know what you mean. It sounds alarmist if you don't think about, well, what quantity are you actually eating when you eat a fat salmon fillet, for example.
Yeah.
But it's still the fact that that's all hidden from view is another element.
And the other thing that was, it's sort of the impacts go on and on, because salmon in the wild feed on other fish. So the preferred food for salmon is fish meal, which is mainly made up of anchovies, which is then ground into a meal. So there are some big feed companies. The Tasmanian farming industry buys from these fish meal companies, and even that was quite murky, you know, because the countries in South America that produce this meal have basically wreaked this entire destruction on their own environments and oceans to provide this fish meal, you know, and then it just goes on and on. And because that was becoming quite expensive, they looked into other sources of protein to feed the fish, and this is the really stomach-churning bit, I think. What they use is the bits of chicken, farmed chicken, that humans don't want to eat. So they mash up the beaks, the skulls, the feathers, the intestines, the brains, and they dry it and turn it into like a powder, and then that goes into the fish feed.
That was it for me.
Yeah, that's it.
That was the moment that I did tell the children it's over for salmon. Yeah.
Interestingly though, again, I did think, okay, let's hear the flip side of this. And so the way it was described by someone in the industry was it was this wonderful circular economy using the otherwise waste that humans don't want to eat. And so, I mean, you can spin anything, right? But it's still – sorry, that wasn't enough.
it's not good. It's not good. And it's the fact that then it all goes through them, and especially the antibiotics, they can't digest, and so it just gets excreted and settles down on the ocean floor, and so it causes all sorts of problems for the environment. So it's not even just you could go off eating farmed salmon just because of the environmental destruction.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if the salmon that comes to you in the shop is
fine,
healthy, which it isn't.
Yeah.
But just the environmental destruction alone was enough to put me off. And it was interesting. He said at one point, coal mining, you know, mining companies would never be allowed to get away with what happens in terms of the destruction to the ecosystem.
Yeah.
So that was really interesting to me. And even agriculture is more highly regulated now. So,
well, you can't see it. I think that's the problem. It's happening below the surface. And underneath these nets, these big pens, because they do go down very deep, there's big piles of, you know, waste, excrement and whatnot, food that hasn't been eaten. And when the ocean floor is lacking in oxygen, it promotes the breeding of these certain worms, dorvalid worms, or I'm not sure how to pronounce it. But so any underneath a salmon feedlot, there's basically piles of waste and all these worms squirming around, and the ocean floor is actually dead. And the other environmental issue is these feedlots are made of plastics, and so there's plastics like washing around everywhere, bits that have broken off, broken nets. You know, it's just depressing.
It really is. But I hasten to add that Richard Flanagan writes in such a warm conversational way that it's still very compelling, engaging reading. I don't want to put people off the book by saying it is depressing. What's happening is depressing, but if you want to read anything about it, he's probably the person you want to have by your side. There's also, you mentioned documentaries. A friend said to me today, Seaspiracy is a documentary she watched. So she said, look, I don't need to read the book. I've seen the documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I found interesting was it made me think of Empire of Pain by Patrick Radden Keefe. And both authors are coming to Adelaide for Writers Week, and I wish they could be in conversation. But I think Patrick Radden Keefe is being live streamed, and I'm not sure how the logistics of that would go. But I'd love to see them talking together, because there are some commonalities in both books, and it's that the shock and the sort of horror that you feel is on two levels. One is, I might be naive, but I still can't believe that companies would do this. So I understand it's profitable in the short term. I don't know if in the long term this can be sustained, but I still don't know how any person can sit on a board of directors of a company and knowingly allow that to happen. That still shocks me.
I agree, Anna.
But that's at one level. And then the other level, which he really highlights, was the government.
The government and the EPA and WWF.
Astounded at what they can get away with, and not just get away with, but the government knowingly enabling them.
Oh, yeah, granting more leases.
I could not understand it, because I don't know what is in it for the government. Obviously, they must get donations. They must get votes. There must be some votes in it.
It just seems so corrupt, doesn't it?
It was bizarre.
I know. I agree. I was really, really shocked. I was expecting it to be a book that would perhaps highlight what's wrong with the salmon industry, but I wasn't expecting the tentacles to reach so far into government. And, in one documentary that I watched last night, the World Wildlife Fund, who certifies one of the Tasmanian salmon industry companies, they're paid an annual fee of $250,000. And they say it's a donation to help with their work. But it just doesn't feel right.
That's not right either.
It's not right, is it? Yeah. And there's so many examples like that in this book.
It was very shocking.
It was.
But the government, look, I don't know what goes on clearly in other states and other countries, but the way he was talking about it, it sounded like this was a peculiarity of the Tasmanian government, and it's happened before. And we remember the Franklin River case when we were at law school, but then more recently the guns.
The logging.
Logging issue. That there's something, I don't know why it is particular to, and it's not, of course, it's not unique to Tasmania, but there seems to be a culture in his view of enabling this destruction and not just turning a blind eye, but really the people that are at the sort of lower level, so the regulatory bodies, just there was a whole example of a big feedlot that needed approval, and the regulatory body, which was there to protect the environment or to manage the environmental impact, said, well, it'll get approved anyway, so we just have to say yes to it. And the two women scientists who said, hang on a minute, this needs a lot more study before, on, you know, impact study before you can approve it. And they were sort of shut down to the point where they resigned from this panel. Then the panel approved it, rustling up enough people to make a quorum by bringing in some retired panel members. And then in the approval report, they named the two scientists as if they had approved it.
That's I couldn't believe
the level of it was fraud, basically. Yeah. And in my view, defamatory if you're a scientist to have your name on something like that. But the fact that they did all of that because they were told by the government, or they understood that the government wanted it approved. That was sort of blowing my mind.
The other thing that you think, okay, why does the government want it approved? Does it provide a lot of jobs? Because that's, you know, perhaps a reason. But
That was the case with the logging, wasn't
it? Yeah, but Flanagan goes through and basically debunks that as a myth. It's sort of portrayed as if it does provide a whole lot of opportunity for Tasmania, but in reality it's not one of the bigger industries after all, even though we're kind of led to believe that it is. So he's covered so many angles, but I would like to end on a positive note,
please, because I haven't got to the end. And I said to Amanda, I really hope there's something positive at the end.
Well, I think there are two positive things. One is awareness, raising awareness, because that does have an impact on people's behaviour. And if people like us are not going to buy farm salmon again, you know, that will ultimately have an impact. It might force the industry to tidy itself up. And it's not that salmon can't be farmed in a sustainable way. It's just that they're kind of getting away with stuff that is destructive. So the way forward for farm salmon is to actually take it inland. And this has been happening in some other countries, I think in the Middle East. So they build massive, I guess, tanks. So, and they have this system where they can clean and reuse the water, and it's not being pumped back into the environment. They're taking it out of the oceans and waterways, and they can, in that way, I believe, produce a healthy product that is not destructive to the environment. So that's kind of the next step forward in the salmon farming industry.
Is that nice for the salmon though? Because the way he describes the sort of wild salmon, he said they're described as a noble animal, which is reserved for very few animals because of their life cycle. The way they live in the wild is the, you know, the swimming and then going upstream to spawn, and then they do it about three times in their lifetime. But it's the most, this sort of this epic journey.
Yeah.
And that's the farming seems to be the antithesis of that.
Oh, I'm sure it's not nice for the salmon. But I guess if people are going to demand and eat salmon as a source of protein, then doing it in a way that's more humane and less environmentally destructive is probably a step forward.
There must be a sort of equivalent to free range.
Yeah, yeah.
Farming, I don't know. But I'm sure it would be significantly less profitable in the short term.
Yeah, well, they'd have to spend a lot on infrastructure. I think that's probably why.
And, well, there'd have to be far fewer fish per square metre.
Which there should be anyway, but that's not happening.
I know.
But also, just very quickly, I've watched a few documentaries about the Canadian salmon industry and the South American, and, you know, they suffer with similar problems. For some reason, the salmon industry seems to be quite protected by governments.
Why
I don't get
is
it.
That?
I don't know.
Because I thought the Canadian salmon would be good. No.
Well, unfortunately, the way they've got it, that because Canada has a lot of wild salmon still, a lot of the disease, they've placed these farming pens in a lot of the migratory routes of the wild salmon, and the disease that the farm salmon have has passed on to. And one year they had 10 million less fish, you know, jumping up the rivers to spawn than expected. Because and they'd all died of some mystery disease. It's not good.
That's not good, is it? But still, sounds like there are some ideas afloat, so to speak.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, sorry to bring the bad news.
Sorry.
listeners. But that was it. I think it's a really important book, and I'm interested to hear Richard Flanagan speak about this. So that was Toxic by Richard Flanagan. And coming up next week, Annie and I are reading The Fell by Sarah Moss, which I'm looking forward to. And in the meantime, you can email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go. I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at A. Bailey Karras. And Amanda?
I am on Instagram at vibrant_lives_podcast and Facebook at Vibrant Lives Podcast.
Wonderful. We'll see you next week. Bye.